The letter that we're going to study today is the church, and it's the passage that has that famous statement from Jesus, "You have left your first love." This church needed radical candor. Jesus needed to confront them that they didn't have their love tanks full. And so today we get the opportunity to take a fresh look into our lives and just ponder the question, how's your love tank? Is it full? Or, cue the Jackson Brown playlist, are you running on empty? And for everybody under 40, I apologize for that reference you did not get. Are you full? Or are your love tanks running on empty? Let's take a look at this. I want you to take your Bible and open with me to Revelation chapter 2. Last book of the Bible, easy to find. Revelation chapter 2. Now we call this series Retweet. And if you are familiar with the social media platform Twitter, you know that messages, when they are sent or read, they're called tweets. And so every tweet that gets sent out and viewed, we looked at this last week. Research says that the life of influence for that tweet is about 24 minutes. Less than half an hour to influence people. But you can stretch the shelf life of a tweet by retweeting it. You pick it up and you send it out so everybody can see that's in your kind of line of followers. Retweet it. Pick it up, refresh it, resend it. We said, as we look at these ancient letters that Jesus has written, we want to retweet them. We want to get our eyes on them in a fresh way. And in our age and in our church and in our life, we want to retweet it. We want to let Jesus speak through these ancient words to us. Now, also kind of in the Twitter terminology, each of these messages, we're going to title them with an at sign. And all of the locations of the cities and the churches, we're going to give them that kind of at, just like we do on Twitter, at whatever. And so these messages are going to be titled with that. Today is going to be at Ephesus, okay? So if you're a note taker, just write at Ephesus, and let's take a look at what Jesus has to say to that church. Now, as we move into each of these messages, one thing we want to do is kind of encapsulate the verses of Scripture that relate to the letter that Jesus sent to that particular place by putting it into a shortened kind of tweet formula. So we're gonna actually retweet all of these messages from Jesus, but we're going to take the words that he shared, condense it down 280 characters or less. So here is kind of Jesus' tweet. If he were to tweet this, what he put in seven verses, here's what I think he might say to all of us at Ephesus: "Your faithful hard workers, and you're extremely careful in what you believe, but where's the love, y'all? You've lost that love and feeling. Stop doing life without it. Get your first love back now." That's what Jesus is saying to us. Don't live life with an empty love tank. Get your first love back now, all right? As we look at all of these letters, there's going to be a familiar pattern in how they are written. There's an introduction, which includes who it's addressed to, a word about Jesus. There's also a main body and a closing, where Jesus is always going to say, if you've got ears to hear, if you're willing to listen to this, I want you to listen carefully, make application, live this out. Now, let's take a look at the introduction. Verse 1. It says, "Write this letter to the angel of the church in Ephesus." Now, it's addressed to the angel of the church at Ephesus. Who is the angel? Well, there's a couple of options. One would be, is we see this as like a spiritual being, an angel, a spiritual being who maybe has the assignment of like being an overseeing angel for a particular congregation. So it'd be like if there was an angel, a spiritual being who had the assignment of kind of hovering over and guarding over and protecting over the people called Turning Point. We know in Scripture that there is a hierarchy of angels, and oftentimes you see angels with assignments of protecting God's people and sometimes bringing a message to God's people. So that's a possibility, but it is far more likely that the person being referred to as the angel of the church, you would take the word angel as it appears in the Greek, angelos, A-N-G-E-L-O-S, which simply means messenger. So what he's saying is to the messenger, to the primary spokesperson. We might say it this way, to the pastor at the church of Ephesus, write this. All right, so it's addressed to the spokesman, the pastor at the church at Ephesus. Now, as you hear that Ephesus, let's learn some things about this community and this spiritual family at the place called Ephesus. We're going to put a map up, and the map shows you that all the locations of the churches we're going to look at are in modern-day Turkey. It used to be an area referred to as Asia Minor, as you read it in your Bible. You see a blue circle on the map. That is the island of Patmos. That's where John is located as he's receiving these revelations from Jesus. The first red circle you come to from Patmos is Ephesus. Ephesus was on the coast. It was a port city. So all the commerce and all of the trends, all the communication for that region, it kind of came up through Ephesus. So Ephesus became a city of tremendous influence. It was very cosmopolitan, very jet setter. Shakers and movers were a part of the Ephesus community. Also, it was very Roman. Oftentimes, Ephesus was thought of as kind of Rome's mini-me in that part of the world, because they had everything that Rome had by way of amenities. There was a forum, there was a Colosseum, there's an amphitheater. All of those benefits of Rome were now represented in Ephesus. It carried a lot of political weight. It wasn't the capital, but it was where the governor resided. So a lot of the discussions and debates about things that influenced the whole area happened in the community of Ephesus. They also had a reputation for being very kind of large in the occult, renowned in the dark arts. In fact, when you find the gospel coming to Ephesus in Acts chapter 19, we read that many people had witchcraft books, and they had other devices that they used to communicate with spiritual demons. And so when they came to Jesus, they burned all of those devices. So it's a church that was in a place that was very, very dark. Now, let's think about some things about the church in Ephesus. It was founded by Paul, along with some other people. Priscilla and Aquila were also there as that church was started. It's widely recognized by historians as being the largest and the most productive and influential church in the ancient world. If we were to put that map back up and you were to look at those cities again that were outside of Ephesus, all of those locations, theologians believe Ephesus was the missionary church that sent out missionaries to start all of those other churches and all of those other communities. So a very evangelistic, mission-minded congregation. The Ephesian Christians also took seriously their call to follow Jesus radically and completely. So all the ways in which Jesus describes what a Christ follower looks like in the New Testament, where Jesus is saying, man, if you're going to follow me, you got to take up your cross and you got to follow me. All of those descriptions that Jesus offered of how bold you have to be and how to live out your new life, they took all of that to heart. And so as they started following the rhythms of Jesus, following in his steps, listen, literally, it caused a riot in the city as the decisions of these disciples start impacting the local economy of the city. Even the expectations of the culture, well, this is what you're supposed to be and what you're supposed to do, they would not line up with any of those cultural expectations, and it was turning that community upside down. We read about it in Acts chapter 19. So they take to heart Jesus' call to follow him radically and fully. Here's the last thing on the church. Most Gentile churches, churches that were founded outside of Israel, struggled to have kind of a good moral center because they didn't have the benefit of the law. So they didn't know what God had outlined in terms of good moral behavior. And so when they came to Christ and they started planting and raising up those churches, remember, they didn't have Bibles like we have Bibles. The New Testament hadn't even been put together fully yet. So they struggled to figure out, how do we come out of paganism? How do we live a moralistic life? Well, all these churches were struggling. That's why Paul writes so much about it in the letters that he sends out that we have in the New Testament. Because they're struggling to figure out, how do we do this thing? But it was the Ephesian church that had an unusually large number of Jewish-born converts to Christ who were familiar with the teaching of the law, the moral standards, if you will. And so they seemed to have a better moral compass than most of the other congregations around them. So this is a great church, right? Right? This is a great church, a great people in a great city. Jesus goes on to introduce himself to this church at Ephesus as, look at the message from the one who holds the seven stars in his right hand, the one who walks among the seven gold lampstands. Now, in each one of these introductions in the letters that we're going to read, Jesus is going to pull from chapter 1, where he's introduced in this new authoritative way. For those who weren't here last week, you need to go back, listen to that message. Jesus, there's a revelation of Christ that's fresh and brand new. John, who thought he knew everything about Jesus there was to know because he was the loved disciple, he's got his back turned to Jesus. He hears Jesus' voice in chapter 1. And when he turns around, expecting to see maybe his rabbi friend, or maybe even, you know, the Lamb of God or the risen Christ, as he turns to see something familiar, he's shocked by what he sees, this authoritative, sovereign, powerful Christ that's being depicted in chapter 1. Now, Jesus takes different pieces of John's description of him in this authoritative way, and he reintroduces it to the church. So in this particular congregation, Jesus introduces himself by reminding his posture with these stars and lampstands. Now, in chapter 1, verse 20, Jesus kind of decodes for us what these lampstands and stars represent. The seven stars are the angels of the seven churches. That's the leaders of the churches. And the seven lampstands are the seven churches. So Jesus here is reminding the Ephesian church, you may think I'm off in heaven not paying attention, but I want you to understand I'm right here in the middle of it. I am very present with you. I see everything that's going on. Now, as we move from that into the body of the letter, Jesus is going to lead, notice this, his radical candor with a compliment. Now, how many of you have ever been through some kind of like management training, or maybe you just had good mama teach you good manners, that if there's something that you want to correct in somebody else, it's always good to lead with a compliment. Anybody ever heard that before? You just kind of start with a compliment. Where did we learn that? Well, we learned it from Jesus. He's going to lead with a compliment. Now, before we read his compliment, let me kind of set the stage this way. How many of you have ever heard a name, Billy Martin? Any baseball fans in the room ever heard the name Billy Martin? There's a few of us. Billy Martin was the fiery manager for the New York Yankees back in the 70s and into the 80s. And Billy loved to win. And so he was known for being, had such a winning passion that he would go fight with umpires over the smallest things because he was like driven to win. One of the things that drove Billy to win is he was earlier in his playing days a New York Yankee. And so managing the Yankees, but having played for the Yankees, he understood their winning tradition. And so he had a passion to uphold what it meant to wear the Yankee uniform. Now, the Yankee uniform at home has a distinctive. It has pinstripes on the uniform. And so it's often referred to as the Yankee pinstripes. Billy knew what it meant as a player to play with those Yankee pinstripes on. It was a privilege to be a part of that winning organization. And so Billy developed a compliment that he might walk around the locker room and see one of his players and recognized how well they played that day by saying, "Now that's wearing the pinstripes. That's wearing the pinstripes. That's what it means to be a New York Yankee. That's what it means to uphold our winning tradition." As we read Jesus' compliment, it's almost like Jesus leans in and tells the Ephesian church, "You're wearing the pinstripes. I mean, you're doing this thing good." Look at verse 2. "I know all the things you do. I've seen your hard work and your patient endurance. I know you don't tolerate evil people." Now, evil people does not mean people out in the culture who don't know the Lord. It actually is referring to people inside their church who are not walking with Jesus. They're saying the talk, but they're not walking the walk. And so they check those people. They hold them accountable to their faith confession. "You've examined the claims of those who say they are the apostles, but not. You have discovered they are liars. You've patiently suffered for me without quitting." It's like Jesus saying, "Listen, you're wearing the pinstripes. I see how devoted you are. I mean, you're even willing to do the spiritual things that are hard to do. I mean, you're committed to evangelism and missions and vetting teachers, discipling and holding one another accountable. I mean, you hold the highest standards of what it looks like to walk with Jesus. You are the epitome of salt and light believers. I know exactly what you're doing, and there's a cost to your faithfulness." When Paul writes the letter of 1 Corinthians, he mentions to the Corinthian church fighting wild beasts in Ephesus. And that little phrase is probably a reference to the fact that Christians in Ephesus were being thrown into the Colosseum to have to fight lions and other wild beasts as entertainment for the people. So these folks are faithful, and they're loyal, and they're hardworking. There is so much to admire about their faith. But with all they were getting right, there was something that was wrong. Something was getting left out. Verse 4. "But I have this complaint against you. You don't love me or each other as you did at first." Now, some translations take a more literal word-for-word interpretation of what Jesus said, his complaint. The NIV, the ESV, the New American Standard Bible all kind of say something similar. "You have forsaken, you have abandoned, you have left." Now, notice this, "your first love." That's Jesus' literal words of the complaint. "You have left your first love." Your love tank is empty. It's like Jesus looked at them and went, "Your love tank is empty." Radical candor. Now, most scholars agree that because Jesus isn't specific by what does first love mean, that it could be him saying, "You have left your first love," meaning Jesus. You no longer love me like you once did. Your loyalty to me, your worship of me, your gratefulness to me, all of that has just slipped. It's not what it used to be. And or it could be love for people. The first love could be love for people. that you used to be patient with people. You used to be compassionate with people. You used to be enduring with people. You used to be generous with people. But now you're not. That's why the New Living Translation kind of leaves this open to be a both and by wording it, you don't love me or each other as you did at first. Their love tanks are empty. Now, many of us, we might be like the Ephesian church reading this for the first time, and we don't feel love deprived. Until you kind of start thinking through, what are the characteristics of when your love tank are empty? And then maybe we start kind of, maybe my tanks aren't as full as I think. Here's some characteristics of what it looks like whenever your love tank is empty. One thing is you emphasize less important things. You start to major on the minors. Anybody ever heard of a church that like splits because of the fight over the color of carpet? Like you vote, you know, who wants blue carpet? Oh, who wants red carpet? And all of a sudden now they got a war on because they can't agree on the carpet color. How many of you know that carpet color is a minor and not a major? But whenever your love tank is empty, you major on the minors. Like in my house, it might look like this. Hey, does anybody not know to turn off the lights? This costs money, you know. Why are you leaving all the lights on? Now, if you do the math, it's probably like 12 cents over the last hour. But when my tank is low, it's like, how dare you leave the lights on, right? When your tank is low, you major on the minors. Or how about this one? You get your doctrinally right, but no passion. You believe the right things, but there's no passion. That's when your love tank is empty. I can remember getting a chance to attend a church that I had kind of held in such high regard and fondness because, you know, listening to their pastor preach on the radio was a great discipling influence in my life as I was saved and called into ministry. I loved tuning in and listening to this particular teacher teach because he taught me so much. He had such an incredible command of right things. And I could not wait during my doctoral studies when I was in the same city, the school's in the same city as that church, I would have a chance to visit the church. And so I was there one weekend, and I'll never forget, I was walking in, almost kind of like a kid in a candy shop. I was so excited to be there to actually listen to this guy teach from like his pulpit, the things that I'd heard all of my life. And so I got into the room. There's thousands of people in the room, and I could not wait for things to get started. And they start the service, and it's just, guys, it is dead as a doornail. I mean, nobody sing, nobody talk, nobody smile, nobody clap, nobody, nothing. Just dead. And got up to teach, and it's awesome, and just truth, I mean, doctrinally right. But there was not a drop of passion in the house. When you have the right beliefs, but there's no fire in your heart, when your head is full, but your heart is empty, your love tank needs a boost. Or going through the motions, that's a good evidence sign of your love tanks are empty, your routine focus, just hollow, empty obedience, annoyed and easily edgy. Another sign from in my family, I can guarantee you, if you polled them and asked them, how do you know when daddy's love tanks are empty? He is annoyed easily. Critical spirit. Find something wrong with everything. Your love tanks are empty. Avoidance. You drop out of small group, don't want to go to church, don't want to see anybody. Your love tanks are empty. Now listen, life happens. And life will make some withdrawals from your love tank. And it's not hard to find yourself in a place where you're love deprived. And when you are, Jesus' words apply to us right now as much as they did to that church in that day. Look how he challenged the love deprived directly. Look at verse 5. Look how far you have fallen. Turn back to me. Do the works you did at first. Now, whether your love tank is empty towards Jesus or it's empty towards people or both, how we refill our love tanks is the same. And how we do it is we just follow Jesus' simple instruction. Here's the first thing that he tells us to do is we're going to have to be brutally honest with ourselves. Look how far you've fallen. Now, they could have argued with Jesus. Wait a minute. What are you saying? Look at that. We've planted all those churches. I mean, we walk it out. We are loyal even in the face of death. But you're a long ways away from where you need to be. Because your love tank is empty. It doesn't matter all the stuff that you do that you might be getting right. Your love tank is empty. And you're going to have to be brutally honest with yourself about that. I mean, you can fool the person sitting next to you. But you're going to have to take a real brutal self-assessment. Are they empty or are they full? I don't do a lot of counseling because I'm not any good at it. I'm a fixer. And when you bring your problem to a fixer, this is what he goes, 2 + 2 = 4. So don't do that. Start doing this and life gets better. You know, that's my counseling. And listen, that doesn't work for anybody. It doesn't even work for me. But I just have a tendency to just make things too simplified like that. But have you ever been to the mall and you've seen the map? And it has a big red arrow and it says you are here. Yeah. Have you ever argued with that? Here? I'm upstairs, clearly. I'm by Dillard's, clearly, right? In a few like counseling sessions that I have been in, people will like kind of tell me their problems, and I get finished telling me their problems. Okay, well, what you're saying is you are here. You're here. I'm back here. Wait a minute. The facts that you just outlined tell me you are here. Nah, I'm here. Sometimes I get invited in to do like church consultations and I'll meet with leaders and they'll bring out all of their information. I go, okay, what you're telling me is you're here. No. We're here. Wait a minute. All the numbers say you're here. Yeah, but no, we're telling you we're here. In order for us to get where we need to be, Jesus says the first thing is you're going to have to be brutally honest with yourself. You can fool everybody around you, but honest with yourself. Jim Collins, a source I love to read Jim Collins stuff. Good to great, he makes the comment of you got to learn how to embrace the brutal facts, because facts are your friend. It's the truth, and it will help set you free. But you got to start here. Look how far you have fallen. Where are your love tanks? Secondly, Jesus says, turn to me. So the second thing, not only being brutally honest about where we are, but we need to open ourselves up to, listen, a touch from God. Because when your love tank is empty, it's going to take more of a spark to fill it up than you can generate on your own. And so Jesus says, turn to me. There's a relational piece of that that's not unimportant. We're going to have to turn. We're going to have to connect to Jesus. We have to be with Jesus, abide with Jesus. There's a part that's very important. But it's also equally important to recognize that in turning to God, it's a recognition that the spiritual need for being refilled is something just a little bit above our pay grade. We need God to spark something inside of us that will begin the refueling process of bringing our love tanks back up. We need Jesus to just give us a touch. There's just something about what Jesus can do for us that we cannot do for ourselves. I love the story in the Old Testament of those dry bones in the valley. Bones that can come back to life again. When God speaks to those valley of bones, he can cause an army to rise up and a wind to fill their lungs. But Jesus has to speak that word and he has to do that touch. And there has to be a humility on our part to recognize when the tanks are low, Jesus, I need your touch. I need you to work in me deeply because my tanks are so empty. Just a point of vulnerability with you. My wife and I, our relationship is so strong today. But there was a moment when it was not so. I said in the first service that it was 15 years and I got corrected. She said to me when the service was over, she said, oh, I love that shirt on you. But it was 7 years, not 15. Did you hear the compliment? Did you hear the compliment? But she just said, and it was 7 years. But we came from such different families, very different. And we were very different individually. Personalities were very different. Gifting's different. And we had a sick child. We were serving in our first church as a pastor. Just a perfect storm of so many things. And it had gotten to the point that literally we were like, you know, habitating the same address. And that was about it. And just the love tanks were just empty. And there were many, many, many days that we just agreed that we weren't divorcing just because we said we weren't. But there was not a love bond, and there was just, it just wasn't there. And I hate to admit that to you, but I'm just telling you the truth. For 7 years, it was just an ugly grind. I went to a conference, I don't know if it's what you'd call it. It was really, some of you might remember, there was a thing called the Toronto Blessing, and there was kind of a move of God and a revival happened in Toronto, Canada, and I'd heard about it. And again, my heart was just so dry and empty. And so I went. And it was interesting. I mean, if you ever read about it, I mean, there's thousands of people there. And I promise you, there were thousands of things going on in the room all at the same time. It was fascinating. And I hate to admit it, also entertaining. As I'm kind of watching God just, I mean, there's just stuff going on. I'm like, what? I mean, just you're watching all this stuff happen. But it was undeniable that in the soup of all of that, I just begged God to touch my heart because it had gotten so dry. The tank was so empty. And Jesus sparked something inside of me in that moment and renewed and regenerated to where I could come home. I could come back from that experience, from that touch from God, and could begin the process of humbling myself and loving my wife in a way that she needed to be loved. But I could not get there on my own. I needed God to do a touch in my life, to do a work in my life. But here's the great news. God can. Jesus can work miracles. He can cause armies to come back to life. He can cause dead hearts to come alive. He can cause love tanks to be filled. A touch from God. Third, last thing, is we have to make the right deposits. This is how we fill our love tanks. We have to make the right deposits. Jesus says, do the works You did it first. The word works is the word energē, where we get our word energy. We are going to spend energy doing things. But there comes a moment where you recognize the importance of investing your energy in the right things. I watch families, I watch people all the time make decisions to where they've got all this stuff going on at home. They got all this stuff going on in their business. They got all this stuff going on in their school. We're busy people. We will spend our energy, will we not? Come on. We'll spend energy. We'll go in every direction you can imagine. But there comes a time where you point your energy in the right direction. And we start to do some things that help to bring love back into our tank. Yeah, it takes Jesus to give us a spark. But then we have to commit our energies to doing something. And sometimes it's little things. Just the little daily things. Like spending time with God again. So grateful for the people at Campus Crusade who taught me as a college student how to have a time alone with God every day. And doing those little things helps to bring that love tank back up. If you like wrote your wife or your spouse, little love notes whenever you were dating, when you were starting to form that love, will you kind of find a way back to some of those little things? If you used to pray when you pulled up to your workplace, knowing you were going to go in there with some people who were going to set you on edge, and you used to sit in the parking lot and just pray a little prayer, God, give me some grace, give me some compassion, give me some patience in dealing with people today. And you used to have patience for people because you used to pray that little prayer every day before you walked in. Sometimes you got to go back, watch, and do the little things again. Sometimes it's big things. Maybe you got to bring a pastor into the picture and, hey, will you pray with us? Maybe you got to go through marriage counseling. Sometimes there are the bigger things that we need to do. But the point being made by Jesus is whatever you've got to do in order to refill the tanks, isn't that worth it? Put your energies there. So how's your love tank? Is it full? Or are you running on empty?